Well, I'm here now to see Mark Curtis from the World Development Movement and also author of Web of Deceit to find out more about the G8 and Britain's foreign policy. Mark, if we could just start with asking who are the G8?
Well, the G8 like to describe themselves as the world's leading industrialised countries, and they're among the largest economies in the world. But the G8 itself is a self-appointed group of nations. I mean, these countries have taken it upon themselves to organise this annual talking shop. And I think it's important to realise that the G8 is really a management board for the global economy. I mean, these are countries who have reshaped the global economy to function really in their interests over the last few years. And they would ideally like to be meeting behind closed doors without the glare of media attention and certainly without public attention to get on with the business of deciding everything for the rest of us. But of course, I think that public pressure and public opposition to their policies has made sure that that doesn't happen and that won't happen.
How long have the G8 as a group been When did they begin? When was it set up, and who was it who set it up, and for what purpose?
Well, they've been meeting for well over a decade, and I should say it's a fairly informal grouping, really, or at least the meetings began fairly informally. I mean, as the years have gone on, they've discussed more and more issues, and then they discuss a whole range of economic, social, political issues, and really see themselves as the shapers of the global economy.
And is it the economy that is the primary concern for these members?
Well, I think that the G8 nations have a very clear and simple project in the world, and it is to impose a very particular kind of economic model on the rest of the world, which you can call corporate globalization or market fundamentalism. That's what they're united in wanting to do. Now, of course, they don't say that. They don't say that's their aim. They say their aim is peace, democracy, and human rights. But their real aim is to ensure that the global economy functions in the interests of the corporations that are based in those countries. And really, that's what they've done. I mean, in the last 10 years, the rules of the global economy on trade, on investment, on services, and so on, have been rewritten in favour of corporations. And it's really been the G8 that have been pushing that, and that they've remained united, those countries, to a large extent, in pushing that agenda in other forum like the World Trade Organization and like the World Bank. So this is an important annual opportunity for this self-appointed group to stitch things up, really, in the global economy in the interest of corporations.
And so who are these members that we're talking about here? Who are the eight?
Well, the G8 consists of four European countries, the UK, Italy, France and Germany, and then the United States, Japan, Russia and Canada.
And how many years have they been meeting, and how often do they meet?
Well, they only meet formally at a high-level summit every year. I mean, there is some contact in between the countries, in between the meetings. But it's these annual summits which are the decision-making, if you like, fora for these eight nations to agree on, you know, their strategies. And that's why it's very important that there is huge public pressure at the time of these meetings, because I think it can have an effect, you know, on what they are trying to do. If there was no public pressure, their strategy and policies would be even worse.
During the G8, there was going to be a lot of talk about democracy and human rights. All those present at the official summit will reaffirm their commitment to these principles while sheltering from their citizens behind a highly militarized security screen. Can you give us a few illustrations of the difference between the G8 leaders who will be saying that and what their political and economic systems are actually doing?
Yeah, I mean, the G8 have an agenda which is fundamentally anti-democratic and fundamentally anti-human rights. I mean, their big project, the big thing that they've been doing over the last few years is trying to impose on the rest of the world what you can call corporate globalization, market fundamentalism. It means the liberalization of trade. It means privatizing public services. And it means empowering corporations and really reshaping the global economy to function in the interests of corporations and profit. And that agenda has been pursued very, very clearly by the G8 in the World Trade Organization, through the World Bank, through bilateral aid programs and so on. And this amounts to a massive attack on democracy, because what it means is that countries are being forced, I mean developing countries mainly, particularly the poorer parts of the developing world and particularly weaker states, are being forced to accept a model which really does not work in their interest. And sure enough, what we've seen in the last 20 years, we've seen the world's poorest countries become even poorer. You know, the poorest countries in the world of sub-Saharan Africa have seen poverty increase over the last 20 years. And we've seen inequality between rich and poor, both within countries and between countries, rising. And I think that all of these things are a direct result of this economic model being imposed by G8 countries, you know, on the rest of the world.
Do you think there's a strong link then between the G8 and groups like the IMF and the World Bank?
Yeah, I mean, the G8 nations primarily control the World Bank, the IMF and the World Trade Organization. I mean, these are the world's powerful states. They would ideally not like to have to go through these multilateral fora like the WTO. They'd ideally like to set rules just by themselves. I mean, the reason why the G8 was set up in many ways was to bypass the more democratic international organizations. Because in those organizations, you have to pay lip service and sometimes actually listen to the world's poorer, smaller members. That's not what they want to do. They have a very clear project. They want to impose it on the rest of the world. They will do that if they can. And the big things stopping them imposing their agenda are, first of all, opposition from the public and demonstrations actually at and in the run-up to these meetings. And the other thing that will stop them is united opposition from developing countries. I mean, you know, we've seen over the last few years when developing countries remain united in the face of rich country pressure, they can block the rich country agenda. That's happened at the WTO and it's happened elsewhere.
Are there any specific examples that you can give of results from G8 decisions on third world or developing world countries?
Well, I mean, the history of the G8 is a history of broken promises. I mean, what happens every year is that G8 leaders announce a load of high-minded gestures and a range of promises on changing policies. And then, sure enough, nothing materializes. I mean, the big example of that is 5 years ago at the G8 meeting in Cologne. The G8 nations promised to write off $100 billion worth of developing country debt. Only around a third of that has been cancelled. So 5 years later, two-thirds of that debt has still not been written off. I mean, that is just a clear broken promise. And there are numerous other broken promises on aid, on trade, and on, you know, you can look right across the board at these communiques issued at the end of these meetings. They're almost never fulfilled, frankly. So we cannot believe what comes out of these meetings until the policy changes actually happen.
So what is coming out of these meetings then? If the promises that they're making publicly are not being kept, what is happening? What is being organised and agreed on?
Well, I think that these leaders use these fora as a way of discussing strategy to achieve their top-line objectives, really in the other international institutions. I mean, as I say, they do have this definite strategy of promoting further and deepening liberalisation in the global economy, you know, opening up poorer countries to trade liberalisation, promoting liberalised investment rules, promoting the empowerment of corporations. And essentially, I think that is really what they mainly discuss at these meetings, actually, how to further that project, how to deepen the project of corporate globalisation.
When you say the G8 as a group is an undemocratic organisation, and the people who are there are not responding to what the public is wanting. But if we have these leaders from the world's foremost economic and industrialized and forward-thinking countries, if those leaders of those countries are going to these groups, surely those leaders can then place within the G8 agendas or issues that their country, the people in their country, are feeling passionate about or feeling strongly about. For instance, people in the UK and other countries feel very strongly about the environment and global warming. are these not issues then that, say, Tony Blair can take to the table and actually create an improvement or create a debate?
Well, theoretically they could do, but I think that it's a myth to think that these countries, most of whom are nominally democratic, are representing the wishes of their populations in these meetings. I mean, you know, to what extent is Tony Blair represented the wishes of the population of Britain over Iraq? Not at all. It's completely ridden roughshod over public opinion on Iraq. And I think it's the same on other issues as well. I mean, what we see here is an attack on democracy, not a reflection of it. The fact is that the G8 was set up to bypass the only remotely democratic international organization that we have, the United Nations. I mean, the UN is certainly a far from perfect organization, but it is the most democratic of the international bodies. And if global action on climate change is going to happen, global action to make trade rules work for poor countries and so on, then those discussions should really be had in the UN, where poorer countries, developing countries, who after all make up most of the world's population, they have a fairer say than the G8, where they have no say, in the WTO, where they have very little say, and in the World Bank, where they have virtually no say. So, you know, the forum is important. And really, some of the issues that the G8 is discussing shouldn't be discussed by these countries outside of more democratic processes like you might find in the United Nations.
So if these leaders, if these world leaders are not answering the citizens of their country, who they're representing, who are they answering to? Who are they representing?
Well, I think the G8 is primarily reflecting and promoting the interests of corporations. I mean, over the last few years, corporate lobby groups have wielded enormous power. They've got onto the international agenda things that simply weren't there before. And the G8 governments have responded to that corporate lobbying, and they've rewritten the rules of the global economy to function in the interests of those corporations. And they are the real power brokers now behind the international economy and behind the G8. You only need to look at the rules of the World Trade Organization, which, you know, have been rewritten. Before, there were no global rules on pushing the liberalization of trade, on new investment agreements, on new agreements on services. Now there are, and the reason they're there is because of lobbying by corporations. We know that the US agriculture multinational Cargill virtually wrote the first draft of the WTO's agreement on agriculture. We know that the US pharmaceutical industry was responsible for getting into the World Trade Organization the agreement on intellectual property rights, which benefits corporations. And what the G8 is doing is really endorsing that whole approach. It's endorsing this world that's ruled in favour of corporations.
So why would Tony Blair be allowing himself to be represented these corporations and not the people of the United Kingdom? Why would he see it beneficial to give lip service to the corporations rather than those who voted him into power?
Well, I think it's a sign of what the nature of our so-called democracy has become. I mean, the idea that our democracy in Britain reflects the will of people is just totally naive. In my view, and if you go back to the roots of democracy in the UK, the aim of our political system is to keep the public as far away from decision-making as possible. You know, what we're allowed to do is vote every 5 years, and that's pretty much it. What's happened over the last few years is society's been captured by the interests of corporations. I mean, no matter where you look, whether you look in the local communities, which are being taken over by big supermarkets, whether you look in foreign policy, which is being taken over by the interests of corporations, you know, you see governments and a society in hock to promoting corporate profits. And I think this is a direct result of corporate globalization, that now the whole of our economy is really geared towards catering for the demands of transnational corporations and catering for the needs of profit-seeking companies. And governments like Tony Blair's have chosen to go along with that agenda rather than to counter it. They could counter it. They could choose to regulate globalization, to work in the interests of people. They could choose to regulate corporations. They could choose to dampen down their power, but they've chosen not to. They've chosen to empower them further. They've chosen to rewrite the rules in the interests of those corporations.
So when Tony Blair or other G8 members say in public that the environment and global warming is going to be a priority discussion at the G8, what do you think he's actually saying, or what do you think the outcome will be?
I mean, governments lie. They lie all the time. I mean, as I know from looking at thousands of secret planning files, that, you know, what civil servants and ministers have really been doing in private compared to what they're saying in public, they lie all the time. And what we're being subject to at the moment is a massive public relations and propaganda exercise, similar to over Iraq. You know, over Iraq, we saw the biggest public relations propaganda campaign that we've seen in recent times, to essentially lie to the public and to deceive the public. I think the same is happening on Africa, on development, and on environmental issues, where the G8 leaders claim to be doing everything in their power to address these issues, but in reality, they're making things a lot worse. And I think that it's our task to see through the rhetoric and to see it for what it is, which is rhetoric and lying and deception, and to expose their policies for what they actually are. But we shouldn't fall for, and I don't think the public have fallen for it, to be honest, which explains the demonstrations, you know, that always accompany these meetings. We haven't fallen for it.
That was one of my other questions, is going to be about the demonstrations that seem to accompany these meetings. Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many people feel a need to do this?
Well, I think that there is a global attack on democracy taking place around the world, represented by this model of corporate globalization. People know that their societies are being taken over by corporate interests. And the global justice movement is a fight back. I mean, it's people reasserting their own priorities, interests, and rights in the face of this big corporate onslaught onto their societies and economies. And I think that what people are doing now around the G8 and what they've been doing at high-profile summit meetings over the last few years is fighting back. I mean, this is a global resistance movement to counter the domination of transnational corporations over the global economy. And it's happening in Bolivia, in Indonesia, in South Africa, in India, in virtually every country you look at around the world. There are huge social movements, civil society uprisings, demonstrations, protests, happening regularly, actually happening all the time. You won't read about it in our mainstream media, but it is happening all the time. And I think it's a genuine global democracy, pro-democracy and pro-social justice movement. And I think actually that we have put the powers that be on the back foot. And sometimes I think we get a bit too depressed about how our priorities are being shaped by them. But I think we've not, this global movement has notched up a huge number of successes over the last few years. I think it has been a successful, in many ways, fight back, but there's much more that can be done. But it is perhaps the first really genuinely global movement in history.
So what if these members of the G8 are not responding to pressure from the people from their countries, the countries that they're representing, and they're representing the corporations. What do you think their ultimate aim is? I mean, why are they doing that? Do they want to destroy democracy? Or
I think they see democracy as a threat. You know, the public controlling or influencing policy is a threat. That's not what our political systems are set up to do. Our political systems are set up to enable a set of elites, after they've been elected, to do what they want for the next few years with minimal public accountability and minimal public scrutiny. And they have a clear agenda of promoting corporate globalization around the world. And the only thing that's going to stop them is not traditional politics, because it's clear that all the mainstream parties in the UK and in most of the other countries in the G8, they all stand for the same thing. The only thing that's going to stop them is major public opposition and public protest. Because without that, then their agenda is going to be successful. And only us can stop them.
How do you see that happening with previous summits where there have been demonstrations and direct action, which especially recently seem to be more and more confrontational with the police and the army and ever more violent, how do you think that can then actually become a positive?
I mean, I think the protests and the demonstrations have had enormous successes over the last few years, and sometimes we don't recognise that. The campaign to stop the multilateral agreement on investment, this big European-wide global campaign a few years ago to stop a new charter for investors' rights around the world, was stopped. The Jubilee 2000 campaign got debt issues onto the global agenda and forced some G8 countries to at least take debt much more seriously than they were, and some debt has been written off as a result. By no means enough, but some. The protests in Seattle, I mean, the famous protests 5 or 6 years ago now at the WTO, put the issue of international trade on the political agenda for the first time ever. It made the issue of forcing trade liberalisation onto the poor a major political issue, a public issue. No one knew anything about trade before those protesters in Seattle put it on the agenda. And what all these protests have done is serve warning to the powerful that they can't just impose their agenda around the world. There is massive opposition to it. And there are various successes that have been had in countries, reversing privatizations, reversing World Bank liberalization policies, you know, keeping out US corporate interests. A huge number of successes have been had. You know, campaigning and protesting and demonstrations and direct action works. And that's been shown over the last few years.
Can you give us some commentary on the Tony Blair Brown Bono initiatives on Africa?
I mean, I think the British public have been subject to a huge propaganda campaign by the British government in recent months. I mean, to read the mainstream media now, you'd think that Blair and Brown were the saviours of Africa and the global champions of poverty eradication. But you only have to look at their policies to see the reality. You take debt, for example. I mean, the British government gets a lot of praise for calling for the reduction or cancellation of some countries' debt. But poor countries only get debt. They don't get debt for nothing. Debt relief for nothing. They only get debt relief once they agree to a package of economic measures that the World Bank insists on. So you only get debt relief if you promote privatization, trade liberalization, and let corporations into your economy. That's the only terms under which you get debt relief. Now, I think this explains why the UK government is so keen on debt relief, because it is a lever to push this model of corporate globalization onto poor countries. And I'm fed up, frankly, reading constantly in the media about how wonderful the British government's policies on debt are, without mentioning the simple fact that they are accompanied by these other economic policies which make the poor poorer. So and you can look at aid. I mean, aid is pushing in the direction of forcing privatization and trade liberalization onto developing countries. Britain gets a lot of praise for apparently being one of the largest aid donors in the world. It's completely untrue. Britain ranks 11 out of 22 donors in terms of the percentage of Britain's national wealth that goes to overseas aid. So it's in the bottom half of aid donors. It ranks, I think it's 11th out of 15 in the EU. So the idea that Britain is very progressive on development is a complete myth. In fact, Britain has probably been the world's leading champion of free trade and of this model of corporate globalization, which is doing so much to harm the poor. I mean, really, we should be slating the British government. I mean, if the media were doing its job, it would be criticizing the government every day and exposing British policy for what it is, part of the problem, definitely not part of the solution.
Do you think it is constructive for people like Bono and anybody else who may be in the public light to get involved with these kind of initiatives, sir?
Yeah, I mean, when people like Bono and Bob Geldof, when they do talk about Africa, it can bring attention onto the issue, undoubtedly. But once it goes beyond that, it's important that they are saying the right thing. I mean, I was pretty distressed when I heard Bono refer to Blair and Brown as the Lenin and McCartney of development. I mean, that is just an embarrassment. I mean, to me, they're the Lenin and Stalin of development. I mean, they are part of the problem, not part of the solution. So it's good when attention is drawn to Africa, but the point is, why is it that poverty is rising in Africa, the inequality is rising in Africa, you can trace a lot of that back to British policies. Britain is selling arms to many countries in Africa. We are forcing the privatization of water in many countries in Africa. We're forcing the free trade on many countries in Africa, which is all having the same effects everywhere, rising inequality, rising poverty. So, you know, Britain needs to be pressured into reversing its policies, not praised for them.
It would seem to the man on the street, it seems strange that, especially like Tony Blair, who promotes himself as a truthful, honest, and caring leader, it seems strange to maybe many people that the actual actions, the results of his actions and his policies, are leading to a wider inequality and more harmful to developing nations in the world. So, why would Tony Blair and other leaders be seen to promote the opposite of what most people in the world would actually want, which would be a fairer world? And if those policies are, these policies that they're using, are these the only policies then that are actually workable? Maybe this is why they've chosen this direction.
I mean, I think what Britain is promoting is the interests of the elite within British society. And the idea that Britain's policy overseas represents the interests of British people is a myth. You know, when you look at the priorities that Britain has in the world, I think there are two major priorities. One is that what British elites want is they want to maintain their elite status in the world. They want Britain to remain a great power, to punch above our weight and to be an important global power with influence. That's essentially why Britain retains nuclear weapons. That's why we have a highly interventionist foreign policy. It's really a legacy of the imperial and colonial period when British policymakers got used to being a very important power in the world, and they want to maintain that status. The second key goal that they have is to organise the global economy to function in the interest of British and Western corporations. And I think those two goals, the political and the economic goal, are very, very clearly revealed in the secret files. I mean, when you look through these recently declassified files of Whitehall planners, what they really want, those two goals come through crystal clearly. And all this stuff about promoting development and promoting human rights, I mean, whilst some of those politicians might well actually believe it, because frankly it's convenient to believe that you're promoting some moral goal, isn't it? In reality, I think that the actual interests that they're promoting are very, very different. And if you think about, well, who has influence over Britain's foreign policy? It's clearly not the public. I mean, what influence do we really have through any formal democratic mechanisms? Very little. You know, the people that have the ear of Tony Blair are the big corporations, frankly. They're the big interest groups who can get the ear of ministers and influence them in some way. It's very difficult for the public to do that. And you know, the British economy is dominated by transnational corporations. I mean, you know, the interests of the city as a financial centre in the world, many of the world's largest trading corporations that depend on access to overseas markets are based in Britain, whether it's Shell or BP or British American Tobacco or whoever it is. You know, it's a long list of corporations. What they want is access to foreign markets. They want a global economy that gives them investment opportunities and investment rights. And the traditional role of British governments has been to ensure that that happens, that there are few barriers to their ability to trade throughout the world so they can make large profits. And that essentially, I think, is the primary foreign economic goal of British governments. And it's all dressed up in nice sounding language about human rights and democracy and promoting overseas development.
Brings us on to the next question. In your book, Web of Deceit and Unpeople, you use the public record to outline the difference between official propaganda and the actual practice of British foreign policy. There are a few other people who do this, notably John Pilger, Robert Fisk. Why do so few other British journalists and intellectuals engage in this? And what are your views on the British media system?
I mean, it's true that there's not many, certainly academics, and there aren't that many, in my view, journalists who are really what I would call genuinely independent. I mean, who really genuinely try to expose the reality of Britain's foreign policy. As for why that is, I mean, I think it's probably a fairly complicated, complex reason for why that is. I mean, I have to say, from my experience of working in the academic world, I mean, all the incentives, and I think it's the same in the world of media, all the incentives are to cooperate with elites. You know, if you say things that elites and policymakers want to hear, you can have a fairly cozy academic world, for example. You can get invited to international conferences and be a sort of highly regarded academic. If you take on the system, if you take on the establishment, it's always much more awkward. It's more difficult to do it. You know, the incentives are to cooperate. And sure enough, I think a lot of academics and journalists have been co-opted by the organisations in which they work. It's easier to not rock the boat, if you like. So I think that's, you know, we internalise the values of the elites. So that criticism is possible. It's not that criticism is not possible, but it's criticism within very narrow boundaries. So, for example, you can criticise Britain's foreign policy for failing in one or two places to promote human rights. But if you suggest that Britain is in fact a major supporter of terrorism in the world, then you won't be able to get that published, or you won't be able to say that anywhere in the mainstream. And yet, sure enough, it is a fact. I mean, if you look at who Britain's key allies are in the world at the moment, Vladimir Putin's Russia, Israel, Colombia, these are among the world's most significant sponsors of terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism. They're all key allies of the Blair government. Yet try saying anywhere in the media that Britain is a sponsor of state terrorism. You just will get laughed at. No one will take it seriously. You will not get it published. So criticism is possible within very narrow parameters. And, you know, what I think of the media is that there are some, of the mainstream media, there are some spaces to get critical views across, but very, very limited spaces. And, you know, sometimes next to nothing. I mean, I think television news, for example, is little short of pure state propaganda. I mean, I think that at least within some of the print media, there is some space for dissent. But I think on television, the amount of space for critical documentaries is declining all the time. And the mainstream television news broadcasts have just become deeply embarrassing. I mean, they're little short of state propaganda organs.
Why is the corporations on this kind of world domination agenda?
Well, corporations want to make profits, and they will seek profits wherever they can, and they will seek access to foreign markets. They will broaden their horizons and try and break down any barriers to those markets that they can. And traditionally, it's been states, governments, that have regulated markets. What's happened under corporate globalization is that the power of states to regulate markets has been undermined by the global rules, meaning that corporations have free rein, often, to come into countries and take over local markets. And that's what that's what corporations want. And we shouldn't be surprised that that's what corporations want. That's what corporations stand for. The big big issue here is that governments have chosen to side with those corporations in that strategy rather than side with notions of democracy and with protecting the rights and interests of people. And that's the sad fact that's happened, that our own so-called democratic governments have chosen to side with corporations.
Do you think then the social movements and the demonstrations and direct action, do you think that's becoming at all a threat or a worry to the members of the G8?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. I think that these people have been quaking in their boots, frankly, over the last few years at the huge range and extent of protest. So much so that they've been forced to adopt the same language as us. they're now talking about human rights and development and global justice. Their policies haven't changed, but their language has changed to try and convince us that their policies have changed. But the one thing that these people don't want is they don't want democracy. They don't want their policies to be influenced by the public. They want to get on with formulating their policies in secret and outside of any meaningful democratic scrutiny. And that's certainly the case in Britain, where there are very few mechanisms for the public to actually influence policy. You know, the formal democratic mechanisms that do exist are extremely limited. And, you know, we're allowed to vote every 5 years, but then outside of that, we're meant to just keep quiet and be spectators. That's our role within the democratic, so-called democratic system. It's not really democratic, of course. Many people have, over the years, called it a totalitarian democracy or an oligarchy or, you know, whatever. But what the social movements around the world are doing is reclaiming a real democracy, which is about participation, and it's about actually deciding things in the interest of people. And it's about doing things ourselves and deciding things in our own interest. And that represents a direct threat, I think, to this elite conception of democracy.